Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Row Show.
All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're glad that you've joined us again.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out with us. We'd love for you to join in the conversation. Just log on to facebook.com/ The Music Row Show and chat alongside with us.
Yep. You can also find us on Twitter at The Music Row Show. And after the show, you can check out Instagram also at The Music Row Show. And in case you haven't heard, Dish subscribers, you can now watch us on TV because Blue Highways TV is now on Dish.
That's right. You can watch us four times a week on Channel 73 all over the United States and for the first time ever right here in Nashville. So we're very, very excited about that.
Absolutely. All right, Scott, the suspense is killing me. Why don't you introduce our guest here?
Well, you know, every now and then writing up an introduction is just terrifying.
Yeah.
This was one of those times because when there are just so many hits and so many artists that have recorded his songs, there's just no way to possibly do this any justice. So at least this guest had the courtesy to write a book.
That helps. Yeah.
Which was Someday I'm Gonna Rent This Town.
It's right here.
It is.
Hold it up to the camera.
So I read the book just to make sure that I'd get it all right and then I wouldn't be terrified.
Right.
Wrong. Because after reading about his crazy life, now I'm just not even going to try. Countless hits written by his longtime pal, with his longtime pal Eddie Rabbit, including Driving My Life Away, Step by Step, I Love a Rainy Night, Suspicion, Dr. Hook's When You're in Love with a Beautiful Woman, Kenny Rogers' Love Will Turn You Around, Kim Carnes' Crazy in Love. These only scratch the surface of his Hall of Fame career. It is such an honor to say, Even Stevens, after 9 years, my goodness, welcome to the Music Row Show.
Yeah.
We're glad you're here.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
So I loved your book, by the way. I was telling even before the show that I loved it so much that my wife was getting annoyed with me because I kept stopping her in the middle of whatever she was doing. And, you got to hear this. And I'd read her a paragraph or two. And so now she's going to read it.
Because it doesn't take that much to get my wife annoyed at me.
I was going to say that really wasn't what was annoying her.
It's just
his voice.
Yeah. I've got it down to an art.
Yeah, I do too, actually. Well, talk about your musical awakening, the one that was so powerful it made you pull over. What was it and why was that such a big deal for you?
Well, that was a big musical awakening. I was in my 53 Plymouth driving home from a date.
Okay.
And I was listening to WOWO in Fort Wayne, Indiana, playing something. It was Mitch Miller or somebody, you know, and all of a sudden this song came on. It was the Beatles. And I just couldn't believe how great it was. And I turned that up as loud as I could, pulled over to the side, and I started growing my hair that moment.
Was it Love Me Do? What song was it?
It was Can't Buy Me Love.
Can't Buy Me Love.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And gosh, I just thought it was so unbelievably different and exciting. And I just quit wearing penny loafers that day. And I grew my hair long and all that stuff that happened to everybody, I think, about that time, you know. But
sure,
it was just such a revelation to me that something could be so exciting, you know.
And so that's what sparked your interest in writing music?
Well, actually, I have a really great friend to this day. His name's Jerry McLaughlin, lives up in Ohio still. Mm-hmm. And he was a barber at the time, and he lived shouting distance from me.
Yeah, right.
Just down the street. I lived in a town of 200, and we had a stoplight, and they took it out because of no use.
Because nobody stopped at it?
The electric bill was too high, I guess. We had a town pump, and I rode my horse to school and tied it out and could see it from my home room. And
wow.
Like Eddie Rabbit used to say, boy, you're Mayberry RFD all the way.
That's it.
And I was. And anyway, Jerry lived down the street, and one day, and he was 5 years older than me, but he was like my big brother, you know. And one day he said to me, what kind of music you listen to? And I said, oh, you know, Paul and Paula and The Twist and all that kind of stuff. And he goes, you need to come down to my house, and I'll play you some music. And he put on Buddy Holly album, mm-hmm. Roy Orbison, Gene Pitney, and Elvis.
Okay.
And I went, oh, my goodness.
You hadn't heard any of those?
No, I hadn't heard anything. Well, I maybe heard Elvis probably.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe how great it was. And I said, well, that's it. I've been reborn.
Off to the races.
Right. So that was really what really got me into music, you know, and really thinking about it. Because my folks were a gospel group, my dad and my sister in Ohio. And I learned how to play a little guitar by strumming along with them. But
right.
they were really into it. And I really wasn't that enamored with gospel music as a kid, you know. So,
right.
But I learned a little bit of playing. And that's kind of how it all started. But I always loved music. So after Jerry did that.
And your granddad was a musician too.
Yeah,
was it Scottish?
Yes, he and my father and my uncle, my dad's brother Bob, who actually was instrumental in getting me into Nashville. He was a drummer, and they were in a thing called the Scotch Highlanders, and they wore kilts and all that, and they sang Scottish songs at colleges and high schools and all that when I was a kid. You know.
Wow.
Yeah,
I loved that.
And my dad also had a gospel show that was recorded in our living room at the parsonage when he was a minister. And when I was a kid, I mean like five, I'd run the tape machine to record it.
So you were an engineer?
I was an engineer at
five.
And so I was always enamored with the music business, but I wasn't in the business, but I was.
Yeah.
In your mind, you were.
When you're five years old?
I was a big-time recording engineer.
You better believe
it.
You know, reading about your early Coast Guard years in San Francisco, mm-hmm. it had a very Forrest Gump-esque quality to that whole section, because I'm like, you're kidding me. He was there for that. You saw that. You saw so many historic performances by the legends. I mean, how did that time spent influence you creatively, and what performances still stand out in your mind?
Well, I did see some. I know I was writing down when I was writing the book the people that I could remember that I had seen at the Fillmore
right.
and all those venues, because they were free. Some of them were free.
Wow.
You know? I mean, it was that kind of a thing going on there.
And these
at that
were
time.
Bill Graham's shows.
Oh, yeah, Bill Graham was the production company
right,
that did
right.
that. But there was like the Avalon Ballroom, another one, and on the beach there was Family Dog. And I mean, Grateful Dead played there. I saw Hendrix a few times, Janis Joplin quite often, and just the list, just when I was writing them down, it wouldn't end, and I was going, oh, I can't put all these in the book, but it was kind of interesting to know that I saw that many people, you know, Taj Mahal. I saw Area Code 615 there, the first time I'd heard really live country music, really,
right.
you know. And so it was just I've been so lucky to be right in a town when it was something like that was happening. It happened then. And then when I got to Nashville, Christofferson was just happening, and Mickey Gilley, Mickey Newberry, Chris Gantry, you mentioned earlier,
yeah.
Johnny Darrell, John Hartford, those people were just starting to click as songwriters, and it was changing from kind of hardcore honky-tonk three-chord kind of country in a way, you know, mostly.
More polished.
To a little more, well, just different changes and a little more, you know, like Help Me Make It Through the Night. It's a little more earthy and
right.
the lyric of it, and mm-hmm. a little more deep.
Yeah,
you know? Not that the other music wasn't wonderful, but it was just changing.
And I
came here right when that was happening, and I don't suppose if that wasn't happening, I would have stayed, because I was really kind of a rock and roll. I really loved rock and roll at that time.
Sure.
But I liked Creedence Clearwater. I thought that was country when I was a hippie.
Right.
I mean, I really did, because it really is roots country.
Absolutely.
You know?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, and the Eagles and all that.
Sure.
But and people said when I came here, they said, that's not country. And I understood then, you know, that they really weren't a country act. But it was just, I've just been so lucky to hit those times in the movements in the United States. Of music that were so great.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you mentioned in the book was that you owe a lot to a certain drug-crazed rocker who told you your songs were as good as anything on the radio.
Yes.
So how did that moment change your trajectory from Coast Guard to songwriter?
Well, I wasn't real happy to be in the Coast Guard at that time, because I was really liking the music business. You know, I was really liking doing, being around music a
sure.
lot. Sure. Even though I did have some great times in the Coast Guard, and I learned a lot and saved a few lives, I think, or part of that, you know, mm-hmm. it was rewarding. But a friend of mine was a road manager for a rock group, and he asked me if I had a couple weeks leave coming, and he asked me if I wanted to be a roadie. And I said, yeah.
Sure, why not?
Why not? Because they were from Detroit, and they were members of ex-members of the Detroit Wheels.
Oh yeah,
MC5,
yeah.
MC5, the hard metal group, and they had made this group called Catfish, and they were doing a tour of Whiskey A Go Go in L.A. and the Fillmore stuff and all this. And he says, "Well, I need a roadie for 2 weeks." I said, "Well, I've never done it, but I'll do it."
There you go.
So I got to know these guys, and they were crazy. They were just nuts. I mean, they did every drug they could think of and go on stage. And just, they were great. They really were. But they were kind of wild.
Yeah.
And one day I had been writing some songs in the Coast Guard on my late night watches. I was a radio operator, you know, and I was writing lyrics and stuff. And I was writing some songs. And I mentioned it one night in a hotel. I think it was in San Francisco. And the guitar player said, "Well, why don't you play some?" So I played a couple, and he said, I won't use the word he said, but heck, man, that's as good as anything on the radio.
And well, I went, yeah.
Gosh, maybe I could be a songwriter, you know?
Yeah.
I was a songwriter, and I knew I was writing songs, but as a business, I'd never thought of it, you know?
Yeah.
And then I wondered how you did that, you know, because I was going to be out of the Coast Guard in a few months after that, and I didn't have a clue how you went about becoming a songwriter, really, you know?
There probably weren't a whole lot of books out on how to be a songwriter. Yeah. Yeah. So then how did you figure it out?
Well, it happened overnight.
You came to Nashville and...
Well, that happened overnight. I was an overnight whim. I was in Ohio. It really was. I was getting ready to go to an art school because I was a painter. I also paint and draw, and I wanted to be a graphic artist. And I thought when I got out of the Coast Guard, what should I do? Because I was broke and I had to do something. And I thought, what should I do? And I thought, well, I really like art, so maybe I'll go to the Dayton Art Institute. So I applied to there, and I was getting ready to go there. And I got a phone call from my Uncle Bob, my dad's brother, who was a musician. He was a drummer and a recording engineer here in Nashville. But he wasn't famous at all. He was trying to make it, just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, but he was doing it, and he was playing. I think he played with Charlie Louvin's band and some different people. And he had a band that played down on Broadway at the Demon's Den, which used to be, or which is now the Merchants.
Okay.
That Fourth and Broad. And he said, "You've written some songs." And I said, "Yeah, that's true." And he says, "Well, why don't you come down to Nashville?" And I said, "Well, I don't have any money, and my folks are gone. They're down to Florida right now, and I'm just hanging out at the house, you know." And he says, "Well, if you can come down, come on down." So the next day I borrowed $40 from a neighbor, and I had an old International Scout mail truck with a steering wheel on the other side.
Oh, wow.
and I drove down to Nashville, and I got here about 10 o'clock. This is from a phone call. And I went to the Demon's Den to watch them play and watch them for a few hours. And when it was closing time, there was a guitar sitting back by the bathroom, and I picked it up, and I was playing one of my songs, and Webb Pierce walked by, and he said, "That's a good song." He says, "That'd be a great song for my daughter to record. Would you like me to publish it?" I went, "Yeah, that'd be fantastic." So I ended up down on Music Row in Webb Pierce's office at 2 in the morning, and I sang my song into a reel-to-reel tape recorder and signed a contract on the song.
Man.
And he said his daughter would record it.
Well, Debbie.
Yeah, Debbie. And that kept me in town. I blew off art school, and with the promise that she was going to record my song. You know, I called all my friends in California. I said, "Come on to Nashville.
This is easy.
This is awesome." So weeks passed, and I was living in my Jeep and in his attic when his wife would tolerate it. And I'd go in, and the receptionist, I'd say, "When's Debbie going to record my song?" And she'd go, "Well, she's going to record it any day now." And this went on for weeks and weeks, and I'd keep going back, and she'd say the same thing. And after about 3 or 4 months I'd been here and nothing happened with that song, I went in and I said, "Look, if Debbie's not going to record my song, I want it back." And she goes, "Well," the receptionist says, "Well, I've got a confession to make." I said, "What's that?" She says, "Well, I'm Debbie, and I lost your tape right after I got it."
And so, had she been looking for it, or...
No, she never did find it, and I never got the cut. It was 3 years later I got my first cut.
Oh, man.
But it kept me here, and I fell in with Buzz Rabin and Marie Barrett, who was later married to John Harford. She had a house next door to Glazer Brothers, and fed me sometimes and let me hang out.
We got to take a break, but we're going to come back and talk more about everything that kept you in town. We'd like to let you know that this segment was brought to you by our friends at Toyota of Cool Springs.
Yeah, that's true. Toyota of Cool Springs, one of the great Toyota dealers around. Scott and I are both Toyota drivers, and we just love that dealership. I mean, we've been going there for years, and George is the owner over there. So if you ever go over there, go and look him up, and he'll do a great job for you. They do really go out of their way to make the whole experience of being at their dealership comfortable.
I see people go in there with their dogs, and the front desk ladies will play ball with them.
They have catered lunches and on with weekends. The dogs. That, you know, if you go there, if you're just there, you can have. I mean, it's just like a party almost.
It is.
But at a car dealership. So we really love that place. They have excellent deals, an excellent experience. Go check them out at toyotaofcoolsprings.com. Our guest this hour is Even Stevens, great hit songwriter. We're going to be back with more of him in just a few minutes here on The Music Row Show. Oh, yeah. Welcome back to the Music Row Show.
Oh, hold on, hold on.
Don't be afraid, cause love will show you how. You take that first step, ask her out and treat her like a lady.
Uh-oh, Scott's dancing. Oh, no.
We'll be here.
Tell her she's the one you're dreaming of.
That's the great Eddie Rabbit doing Step by Step. Great song co-written by our guest here this hour, Even Stevens, Hall of Fame songwriter.
What a great song.
That is a great song.
What a great song.
So we wrote that in a cabin one morning right before a session. I was cooking eggs.
Scrambled, what? Over easy, sunny side up, what are we doing?
I can't remember. And Eddie and David Malloy were in the other room at my cabin out in Colorado at Caribou Ranch recording.
Oh, nice.
And I heard them start playing. I went, breakfast is over. And we wrote that song, and within an hour we recorded it.
Oh, that's awesome.
You're serious?
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, you made a great point in the last segment. We were talking about how it turned out that Debbie was the secretary.
Right.
And you make an equally great point in the book how secretaries oftentimes are the people who really run this town.
Yes.
Is that still true today? And what's your advice with deep for keeping up and dealing with gatekeepers?
Well, I met my mentor, Jim Malloy, mm-hmm. the guy who really got me started after I'd been here about 3 years. I mean, he really got me on track. Because he knew so much. He produced Help Me Make It Through the Night by Sammy Smith.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And he was a very famous recording engineer in Los Angeles before he came here. I mean, they just honored him at the Country Music Hall of Fame a few months ago for his work in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But I met him because of a secretary at Ray Stevens' Sound Lab studio.
Okay.
I got to work with Ray Stevens for a little bit, and that was really a thrill because I had bought Guitars and Ahab the Arab and all those records, and then I got to work with him. And when I came to Nashville, I wanted to be a songwriter and a recording artist. That was my dream. And I did some sessions with Ray Stevens, and it came down that he was trying to get another hit after Everything is Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I really don't have time to produce you, but if you want to write for me, I would love for you to write for me. And I said, well, thanks for the offer, but I really want to be a recording artist and a writer, and I want to get involved with somebody like that, So his secretary liked my music, and she told David Malloy, who was a young engineer for Ray, about me, and he stopped me on the street one day and said, my dad wants to meet you, and that's how Jim and I met. So that was a secretary then that caused that to happen. And it's just that, if you're not nice to the people in the front desk, you're not going to get to see anybody. So that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Right.
They've got to make sure that they're getting somebody in there. It's not going to be a jerk to them or something. Or hound them or something, So they hold a lot of power, and I don't think they know that or care about that. I think they're just being great, great secretaries and receptionists.
Right,
and everything. Yeah. But it's very important.
I think we're going to bounce around here because I think I wrote my questions in a fairly linear fashion. But as he's talking, so you came here and you wanted to be a songwriter and a recording artist.
Yes.
You got that chance to be a recording artist. And I love the story because October 8th, Montgomery, Alabama, this had a very important aspect to you. October 8th is my birthday.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, so now every time I think of this, I'm going to think of your... you were finally kind of moving towards your
yes.
your career as a recording artist. So talk mm-hmm. about what changed.
Well, I had a new album out on Elektra Asylum Records,
mm-hmm.
Which was a very hot label at the time from Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
Eddie was on Elektra. And I got a deal with them, and I made an album. Shel Silverstein helped me with the album, and Jim Malloy and Dave Malloy produced it. So I had the chance to be an artist, and I went out on what you do is you go out on the road and talk to people like you, you know, at radio stations and try to get them to play your songs and so forth. And I liked that part of it, but I realized I wasn't writing any songs, and I wasn't. Because I really love writing songs, and I didn't realize how much I liked doing it, and mm-hmm. I didn't have time
until
to do
you
it.
Weren't.
No, I wasn't yeah. doing it because I was playing and traveling a lot, and I was sitting in a hotel in New York somewhere, and a representative from the record label called me and said on October 8th, this in October 8th, which was 6 months away,
okay,
said you're going to be in Montgomery, Alabama at 6 o'clock to talk to such and such, and I. When that conversation was over, I sat on the edge of the bed and I said, I may not want to be in Montgomery, Alabama in October.
At 6 in the morning.
You know, I said, I just don't like this life. I really don't, you know. So I called the head of the label. Steve Wax was his name mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. And I said, you don't have that much money in my project. And I just really don't want to be a recording artist. I've done it now, and it's not what it's not the life for me, I can tell.
Right.
I want to go back and just be a songwriter. He says, well, I've never had this phone call before.
Yeah, I bet.
He says, but that's fine. That's great. And I had been writing some songs, you know, with Eddie, so he was on the label too. So yeah. They weren't really losing the songs that
right.
I was writing for him.
Right.
But I was so happy. It was like a big anvil came off my shoulders that immediately when I hung up the phone, and I went right back to writing songs. Because I think songwriting's maybe the best job you can have in music. It's just,
yeah.
It's fun.
You get to sleep in your own bed every night. Yeah.
You know? If you're lucky, you get paid to do it.
Yeah.
So I was so glad I made that move, even right. though I would have probably regretted it if I had never tried it to this
day. You
would
have always wondered.
Yeah, I'd always wondered if I would have been the right thing. But, you know, I really believe that people recording artists need to have that. They love to be on stage, and they love that. Feedback all the time, and I, it's important, and I like it once in a while, but it's not something that I just desire to have all the time.
Right.
I get that kind of thrill from writing a song and going, oh, thank you, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
For that, you know.
Well, speaking of which, you feel like playing us a song?
Well, I can try. I was saying this guitar is, I've never played this guitar. My guitar, Lucky, is in the shop being worked on.
Okay,
so I'll try
happens.
To play something. I can't play anything really rocking on this gut string, but I'll try.
Well, we've got other guitars if you want to trade out for the next one.
Well, I put that one on, and it doesn't fit my hand right.
Yeah, that's because Scott plays it. Yeah.
Know what I mean?
I hear you.
Okay, but I could... You know, I have a song called Crazy in Love.
Oh,
yeah.
Gosh,
that,
one of my favorites.
That was Conway's last number one. And did you guys know Conway at all?
We did not.
Oh man, what a great guy he was. I mean, really, he was. I used to pitch him songs. You know, he had the on Music Row. He was known as the songwriter's best friend because he really loved songs.
Right.
And I'd pitch him songs. One year, I pitched him a song, or I pitched him three or four songs. I sat there and played them for him, and he goes, "Oh, that's a great song," but after he heard this one song, he says, but it's not right for what I'm doing right now. He says, but that's a great song. Next year, I went to pitch him songs, and he played me on the guitar my song that he had passed on. That's
like he remembered it.
He remembered it.
Yes. I mean, and he was really like that, you know.
Wow.
And I say in the book, at his memorial service, Harold Reed, the bass singer for the Statler Brothers,
mm-hmm.
got up and he said, Conway is the kind of guy when you leave the room, he says something nice about you.
Wow.
And that's the way
that's
he
awesome.
Was. So when he did this song, I was thrilled. This is actually the song that's been recorded the most. Hillary Cantor on RCA did it first.
Right.
A frequent songwriting partner of mine, when she had a deal with RCA, she sang this song. And Conway learned his version from her version. But Julio Iglesias has cut it, and Joe Cocker.
Wow.
Kim Carnes had an AC hit with it, and so did Kenny Rogers. I mean, it's just been so great for me. And it's what I call it's what Scotty Emery calls a full-grown song. It was a real song, you know, from yeah. about something that was going on. Ain't it funny how time steals a feeling from a love affair? And there's no place to lay the blame, 'cause it ain't a case of no one cares. Helplessly you watch it fade away. Neither will admit it, but you're both aching to say, ooh, I miss the days when we were crazy in love, when you weren't so sure of me, and I had my little jealousy. Bring back the days when we were crazy in love. I wanna feel that way again. Remember when we were crazy in love? Oh, it used to be so easy. One touch and you were high. I could get intoxicated just by looking in your eyes. Baby, ain't there anything we can do? 'Cause I know you're missing me as much as I've been missing you. I miss the days when we were crazy in love, when you weren't so sure of me, and I had my little jealousies. Ooh. Bring back the days when we were crazy.
That song has so much air, you know. I just, yeah. I love that song. Thank Always
you.
Have.
Thank you.
Always have.
Well, you have some great stories of various moments in the book of, I don't know how to put it, but imposed humility, which just cracked me up. The Sammy Smith story at the party and
my favorite
Ray
one.
Stevens. Yeah, tell, what are some of the ones that really stand out? And that might be one of them right there.
Well, my very first cut was a Sammy Smith cut. And she right. had just had helped me make it through the night, which was the Grammy
Big
winner.
Hit, yeah.
I mean, it was monstrous.
Yeah.
And then I met Jim, who had produced it about a year, just that same year.
Right.
And got to know Sammy. And over my career, Sammy cut about 13 or 14 of my songs
right.
on albums. And we were really good friends. We ended up, we had a house together actually for about a year and a half.
Oh, really?
Room to together on Belmont Boulevard. And then I opened for her on the road for about a year. So she was like a really dear friend of mine. But when I first got, it was a song called Stormy Weather, one of my songs, and it was my first cut.
Right.
And I was really excited about that, you know. And her album had just come out, and Bob Montgomery, who was a great producer, and he was actually Buddy Holly's partner at one time, early in Buddy Holly's career, singing partner. Anyway, he was a big producer, and somehow I got invited to a party at his, out in the country at this house he had. And I don't know for what reason. I don't.
You just don't question these things.
I thought it was great that he did it because he obviously knew who I was because I had a Sammy Smith cut. So anyway, I get to the party and there's a record player there and there's albums there and Sammy's new album is there. So I'm talking to this girl and trying to impress her and maybe get, you know.
Yeah.
Get lucky.
Right.
You know? Right. And your guitar. Like your guitar.
Right. So I secretly get the Sammy Smith's album on the turntable that it'll come up next while I'm talking to this girl.
Sure.
And it comes on, and she goes, oh, I love Sammy Smith. She is she's my favorite. I just love her.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be good, you know, and my song comes on. So my song comes on, and it's starting to play, and she goes, you know, I love Sammy Smith, but why is she ever decided to record that piece of
Well,
so much for lucky.
Yeah, it didn't work out too well.
Not so well.
So did you end up telling her that you had written it, or did you keep that to yourself?
Yeah. No, no way. I went over and put on George Jones.
Oh, listen, we need to take a break, but we're going to come back with some more of Even Stevens here on the Music Row Show.
That's right. The segment has been brought to you by Dogwood Cabin Rental up in Townsend, Tennessee. Look, if you love Gatlinburg, you love the fun and the moonshine and the restaurants and all of the hubbub, it's a great place, but it's really nice just to go on the other side of the mountain, the peaceful side of the Smokies, to Townsend and enjoy your evenings there. Go to dogwoodcabins.com. Book your cabin for you and your family or just you and your wife. Beautiful cabins, amazing views, and no crowds. Dogwoodcabins.com. That's dogwoodcabins.com.
All right, we're going to be back with more of Even Stevens here on the Music Row Show. Yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show. If you know that song, that's Driving My Life Away. Great big old hit for Eddie Rabbit, co-written with our guest here this hour, Hall of Fame songwriter, Even Stevens. I love what always gets me about that song is that the guitar comes in, it's got a great groove, and then the bass kicks in, and it like, and there's the groove.
It's just coalesces.
And it's so simple, too, and it's just like makes your butt move. You just can't help it.
I got to tell you that. That session was so magic. It was one of those that still I can remember how that felt.
Yeah,
when we were recording that song, Larry Byram plays that great. And when the chorus hits, there's that guitar that comes in.
Yeah,
dun 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 dun. And we had run it down a few times, and I was standing in the middle of the studio, and Larry Byram was sitting. He was from Muscle Shoals. He's a great guitar player. He was sitting on a chair, and we'd run it down a couple times. And when that take was gone, he jumped up and played that lick. And he had never played that one yet because he had just – and it just
hit him.
The air just turned liquid in the studio.
It was
one of those moments, you know, where you go, oh, my goodness. And it was awesome. It was just so good.
I've always said if you want to write with a superstar, step one is move his monkey. I've always said that.
Who doesn't?
What happened with you and Eddie, and how did you guys talk about moving his monkey. And
that sounds dirty.
Remember, this is a family show. Okay.
And what happened when you guys, because you knew each other for a while before you actually started writing together, too.
We did. I had that Jeep, or that International Scout, you know, right. And it was pretty funky, but it was a utilitarian.
Yeah.
And I, another party I was at, Eddie was there, and I had never met him. And it was up on the second or third floor above Bishop's Pub, which is now Tin Angel.
Right.
Those apartments right there. And we were talking by the window, and somehow I mentioned that my Jeep, and he goes, "Hmm." He says, "Would you help me move tomorrow?" and that's the one thing you don't want anybody to ask you at a party, you know.
Right, right.
Help them move their stuff. And I went, "Well, yeah, I guess, you know." He goes, "Oh, that Jeep will come in handy down there." I says, "Well, it's not really a Jeep. It's an International Scout."
Get it right, buddy.
Do you know anything? So anyway, I went over to his apartment that next day, and I walk in, and there's a monkey cage in the living room. And it's about 5-6 feet tall and about that square. And it was kind of funky looking, you know. I mean, the monkey had been in there.
Sure.
And there was a little Capuchin monkey, like an organ grinder monkey. His name was Jojo. And he says, "Well, we can tear that cage all comes apart, and we can throw that in the back of your Jeep." I went, "Whoa, dude."
Where's Monkey?
I said, "I sleep in that. We ain't putting that monkey cage in my Jeep. I don't know you that well." So we ended up tying it up on top of the Jeep. And just like in the movies, we held our hand up there and held it, you know, when we were driving.
Right.
Like they do mattresses, right? Yeah. And we got it over there, and I helped him move. And that's how we met. And we just hit it off as friends, and we hung out together. We went down to Printer's Alley and listened to, you know, Diane Sherrill and different people sing. And
of all the songs you wrote, not a single monkey song.
Not one.
Gosh, what a missed opportunity.
The monkey was a real pain in the butt. <Was it? laughs> I mean, I was the only person that he could let the monkey out of the cage.
Because he was a biter.
Yes.
Oh.
Because he would bite people and pull their hair out. He used to pull my hair out. We'd be right, and he'd come up and get on my shoulder and grab my hair and yank it out occasionally. But he was funny, too. I mean, he knew television. He knew when hee-haw was coming on. The hour before hee-haw would come on, and he'd get all excited and get his food. And he had this Shoney's big boy doll.
Yeah.
And he had torn the top of the head out, and he'd put his vegetables
in the head
of the Shoney's. I know it's crazy, but when hee-haw was coming on, he got that thing ready to eat, and because Eddie had a little TV outside of his cage for him.
Oh, a little hee-haw monitor.
Yeah, he had a monitor, and he also knew when Johnny Carson was going to come on. And he just went nuts when Johnny came out from behind the curtain. He just would scream and holler and everything. It was just amazing.
Oh, man. Too bad there's no footage of that.
I know.
All right. We need to take a break. And if you want, trust me, there's more about Jojo the Monkey. You need to get Even Stevens' book, "Someday I'm Going to Rent This Town," because there's even more. There was an apartment on fire and a mom screaming. And anyways, get the book. You're not going to believe it. We're going to be back with more of Even Stevens right here on the Music Row Show.
Up with your heart, make you a dreamer, believer, believing in love.
Yeah, welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's Kenny Rogers doing a great song called "Love Will Turn You Around," written by our guest here this hour, Even Stevens. That's a great song. I love that.
Oh, thank you.
Now, you know what? It's not often that a lowly songwriter will get invited to play at the Opry. Tell us how that happened and what was that like?
Well, it was frightening.
Yeah.
It really was. I was on Elektra at the time, and okay. I had a record in the 30s.
Okay, so you were that was during the artist phase. Yes. Okay. And, for some reason, I thought that was after you'd become strictly a songwriter.
No, it was. I had a record called "Let the Little Boy Dream." It was
okay.
When my son was born, and I remember, you know, they don't really rehearse.
Yeah.
And you take your. It was a 45, and right before the show. I went backstage, and the musicians were playing on stage, and they came back to the dressing room, and they said, "What you doing?" I said, "Well, my new record." And they said, "What's it sound like? Put it on." And I put it on and I'm getting ready to go on.
Yeah.
And I put it on Jerry Whitehurst and all those people, and I put it on, and they listened to the first verse and half of the chorus, and they said, "Okay,
we got it."
And we're walking out, and I'm sweating. I'm going, my gosh, they haven't even heard of the song Ends or where the turnaround is or anything. And as we're walking out, they're going, "What key was that?" I mean, you couldn't have driven a tack, I'm telling you. I was so nervous doing that.
Yeah.
Luckily, I got to do it twice.
Yeah.
So I do remember the second time, because the first time I was just in it.
But they probably nailed it, right?
Oh, I guess. I don't even know.
Maybe they did.
I didn't faint, so I guess they did. But it was such a harrowing experience.
Sure.
The second time I knew what to expect.
Yeah.
You know, and I did enjoy the... It seemed like it was over in 10 seconds, though.
Yeah.
You know, but wow. It was pretty exciting for me. Because I had been... When I first got to Nashville, I hung out at Tootsie's like everybody else.
Yeah.
And went out that back door and went up and... saw people playing
right
at the top of the stairs there, you know, in the old Ryman. And when they moved then, I got to be on that stage, you know. It was pretty exciting.
Wow.
Man.
Well, we're down to our last 5 minutes. So first off, before we go any further, we're going to have you come back. I hope you don't mind, but we got a ton more questions for you.
Oh, well, that's nice. I would love to.
Okay, good.
You guys are really nice to talk to. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank
you.
So knowing you're going to come back, then I'm going to relax about all these questions I need to ask.
We got to get them all in.
I just want to know, you became dear friends and co-writer with one of my heroes, Shel Silverstein.
Oh.
Tell me about him and just his prolificness and just how you guys connected and wrote together.
Well, I've never met anybody more creative than Shel Silverstein. He didn't go to movies. He didn't watch television. He dated women. That's about his only distraction. And he just wrote and created things. I mean, we all know that he wrote Boy Named Sue
right.
and Cover of the sure. Rolling Stone. And he wrote all those children's books that were, mm-hmm. you know, he's the third largest children book
yeah.
author in the world.
The story I mean, you have about that one,
yeah,
about one of his books,
yeah.
was amazing.
And he was hitchhiking. He didn't drive. And there's a long story with that, but I'll tell you some other time. But he didn't drive, and in Nashville, I had a Blazer, and I was going down Music Row, and I saw him walking down the street, and I pulled over, and I said, "Shel, you want a ride?" And he looked at me, and he goes, "Yeah." Uh-huh. And he got in my truck, and we wrote 5 songs that day.
Wow.
And 3 of them got recorded by major artists.
Man.
Over the next few months. And we just hit it off, just buddied up and wrote songs together and
yeah.
had fun. He was a really fun guy to be around. But he was just so creative. I mean, he did, you know, he wrote plays with David Mamet. I mean, mm-hmm. nobody even knows that.
I didn't know that.
He wrote Broadway plays and off-Broadway stuff, did plays. And he drew, of course, the
yep.
cartoon. He was an incredible cartoonist. I've got a lot of drawings he did for me
Man.
That I just cherish. But he was just, he just really lived and breathed. Being creative, you know, and I miss him so much. I was with him the week before he died down in Key West, and he wasn't feeling well, but he wouldn't go to the doctor or anything. He didn't like doctors or dentists or anything, you know. But he asked me, he said, "How do you like being married?" I said, "Well, it's good. It's a good thing. I like it." He says, "Yeah, you know, I've never been married." He says, "I'm going with this girl, and I'm thinking maybe, you know." And he says, "But every time I hold her, she gets bigger." I said, "Well, don't let that stop you. That's crazy."
Yeah. Nobody would get married if that was the standard.
Nobody would marry me, for that matter. But anyway, he was a wonderful person. I just really loved Shel Silverstein. He was just a good guy, and so he knew. He introduced me to Brenda Lee and Lacey J. Dalton and Bobby Bear and all just great people.
Dr. You know? Hook too, right? Yeah, that did all right for you.
Yes, if it wasn't for him, I would have never had that hit.
Yeah,
he didn't write it with that, me, but it. But he introduced me to them.
There's a great story about that song in the book as well. You just got to get the book.
Look, this book has so many incredible stories. Someday I'm going to rent this town. Where can we buy it? Just Amazon?
Or you can go to my website. I finally have a website. I have never had one. People say, are you out of your mind? You don't have a website? I said, well, I just never got around to it. And it went online about 2 weeks ago. It's
nice.
Even Stevens Songwriter, all run together, small letters, .com. And you can buy it there, or you can buy it at the publishers, Heritage Builders. Mm-hmm. The people that published this published the Rick Hall book that's out about, you know, Man from Fame.
Nice. Right.
That's how I met the publisher of that, was through a thing down in Muscle Shoals.
Awesome.
And
well,
he also wrote, they also published the George Jones book before that.
Sweet. Mm. Well, thank you again. Go to evenstevenssongwriter.com, and we'll see you next week on the Music Rush Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Right on.